Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. I'm happy today to welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Lucinda Jackson. She is the author of Just a Girl, Growing Up Female and Ambitious. As a scientist and business executive, Lucinda spent almost 50 years at 3 universities and 4 Fortune 500 companies, where she experienced and witnessed the unequal treatment of women. This spurred her to write about how to change that dynamic and how to help women find their power. After growing up in California, Oregon, and Washington, she received her PhD in science in Illinois and continued speaking and serving on boards of academic, nonprofit, and industry organizations worldwide. After Peace Corps volunteerism in Palau and teaching science in Mexico, Jackson and her husband returned recently to their home near San Francisco, where she enjoys her fantastic women friends, reading, exercising, and helping others. They're immensely proud of their 3 liberated sons who are scattered around the globe. Lucinda is working on a book series about freedom and breaking old patterns. Thanks for being part of the Morning Glory Project. Lucinda, welcome.
Thank you, Betsy. I appreciate the opportunity.
So this book, Just a Girl, can I ask you how you came up with the title?
Well, my publisher, Brooke Warner, she and I were bouncing around ideas, and she kind of narrowed in on what I was talking about being ambitious. And then we came up with this title. I had the Just a Girl part in there, but the idea about being ambitious was, I really liked it because it clarified things for me. Like, this is the reason that a lot of these things happened to me, is because I had the audacity, I guess, to try to break out of a traditional female role.
So your ambition made you stand out, conspicuous, a target, a threat? How do you see that?
Yeah, all of those, Betsy. It started really young when I was good in math and science in school, and hid my work so that, you know, boys would like me, because I was told by my father that boys didn't like smart girls. Hmm. So it started very early when I was told to, you know, ratchet it down a bit. As my dad said, you need to cut out that crap if you want to have a boy like you. And so it kind of went from there. And I always wanted something more. Even as a very small child, I think a lot of it, Betsy, came from my parents' relationship that was very traditional. My father was the boss and the tyrant, and my mother was subservient. And I saw his life, where he had a job and money and freedom, and I wanted that life, not my mother's life, where she had no voice. She was subservient to him in every way. And it put me in a position going forward that I was always in places where there were no other women. I was the first one. I was a pioneer in many, many situations in my classes in school. You know, I was even in high school, I was the only girl in my physics class. I was the first woman graduate student that my professor had ever had. I was the first field biologist of the company I joined. So I was in a place where there weren't any women, and I was the first one, and the men didn't like it.
Well, so let me get some timing on this. So when your dad said, you know, boys don't like the smart girls, tone it down, ratchet it down, or cut this crap out. What year are we talking about here?
In the 1950s.
Okay. So in the 50s, those were the overtly stated messages.
Yes.
That you were receiving. And somehow you still defied that. You were still a smart girl. And I'm interested in the kind of, it's interesting to me, I was asking about both parts of your title, the growing up female and ambitious part, but the just a mm-hmm. girl part. It sort of makes me think of how they're almost turning those sexist phrases really on their sides in even commercials, like I throw like a girl, you know, those kinds of things. And it seems like in a way that's what you've done. It's like, I'll take that insult and turn it into my book title, Bubba. Yes,
exactly.
And I like the braveness of it.
Yeah. I like that just a girl too, because I had been told that a lot through my life. Well, you're just a girl. You can't, you know, be good at math. You're just a girl, blah, blah. And so exactly that, it was taking that back.
And claiming it. So here you were growing up. And like you said, the only girl in your high school physics class in the probably late 50s, early 60s at that point, and blazing so many trails. What was it like to be the only one in your environment like that?
It was very, very uncomfortable. I created an external image that was nothing like what was going on inside of me. And I created an image of trying to fit in, you know, laughing at the sex jokes when they inside, I had like a parallel Lucinda that lived inside me that was saying, this is not funny. Mm. I'm humiliated. That was awful. But I went along with it in order to, you know, have what I wanted. I mean, I wanted my own money. I did not want to be my mother.
It sounds like you saw that as the toll you had to pay to cross this particular bridge.
Yes. So I stuffed my own personality down for a long time in order to try to get what I thought I wanted.
It strikes me as you tell me this story how many other people of different kinds have experienced this, whether you're Jackie Robinson and you're the first Black man in the major leagues, or whether you're a gay person kind of hiding that or pretending it doesn't bother you when they make the jokes and you're the only out person, or you're not even out for that matter. It just strikes me as it's a too often experienced story of having to have that parallel self that you talk about. That sounds so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can relate to so many people on all the categories that you just mentioned. And I wrote the book for people who feel like they don't have a voice, or had little self-confidence or low self-esteem, or needy for attention, or victim mentality. I wrote it for those people because what I found in this, in my own case with the sexual harassment thing, was that people would say to me, well, I've never been harassed. And, you know, I would just, if somebody did that to me, I would just tell them to, you know, stop it or something. And I say, but see, I wasn't able to do that. I didn't know how to do that. And it's fine to say that if you're one of those people that were raised with confidence, you've always fit in, you can say, yeah, heck with you. And, but when you're like a minority, it's very difficult to, and if you haven't been raised with a lot of self-esteem, it just doesn't come out. And it's very interesting to understand, I mean, you know, why like women don't report harassment. And I mean, a lot of women have played the game for a long time without saying anything because, and so have all those other groups.
Because they saw it as the necessary toll to get across whatever bridge they were trying to get across.
Exactly.
Or like you said, it didn't even come into your imagination to oppose it.
Right.
It sounds like. And if you have a dad telling you boys won't like you if you do that, you know, and you've been told to stop it, to not be so much of yourself. You got trained really early on not to have your own real reaction to such things.
And for myself, it went on for, you know, a long time. I was in probably my just around 30 when I finally started coming out of that and realizing, you know, I sort of found myself waking up angry and irritated and sort of realizing I was my mother. At that time, I'd gone to college, I'd gotten married, I got my first job, but I was acting martyrish and I felt small and sad and tired. And I realized I'd been accommodating to men, my husband, my professors, my bosses, all who were all men for a very long time. And, you know, I'd been a victim of nonstop harassment. So I just kind of walked around with this crushing feeling in my chest. And that's when I started making some changes.
So I want to come to the changes in a moment. But before we go there, tell me what you mean by nonstop harassment, because I think I'm guessing that somebody, say, of a more recent generation, perhaps, might be hearing this and not know what that was for you.
Right.
Can you kind of tell me a couple of stories about what that looked like?
Yeah, it's interesting. I learned a lot of this, you know, later in life. I didn't really understand what was going on or why it was happening. But I, you know, now I know that it's about power plays and bullying. That's what it is. And I kind of figured out there were two types. The first type of harassment I call keep us down. And though that was just the standard, everyday, unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, verbal or physical conduct. And so stuff like, you know, my high school teacher running his hands up my thigh and sending me cards about sex. My boss in my first science job attacking me at a field research site in a cornfield.
When you say attacking you, what do you mean?
Grabbing me, kissing me, putting his hands on my breasts, telling me he wants to have sex with me. And things like my science professor in my graduate school pressuring me to spend the night with him at the research station, being fired because I wouldn't sleep with my boss, being called fried eggs. My boss and my science colleagues at my company had a nickname for me called fried eggs because I was flat-chested and they thought my breasts looked like fried eggs. So that's just run-of-the-mill sexual harassment. That's one type.
And what's the other type?
The second type is what I started experiencing as I got more ambitious and as I rose up the ranks. I got harassed. Some of the overt sexual stuff went away, but this kind I call keep us out. It's about demeaning and humiliating somebody based on their sex, and or trying to protect the male hierarchy. And so things like a boss fabricating and telling everyone, including my husband, that I was having an affair in order to create doubt about my character and, you know, destroy me professionally. Another boss accusing me of cheating on my expense report to invent grounds for firing me because I was the only woman there. And he had overtly told me, you know, we don't want women here. Professor blaming me for mistakes he made in order to protect his own reputation at my expense when I was the only female graduate student. He picked me to blame, right?
Gee, who could I pick?
So there's two types in there. The first one is getting a little better because it's easier to spot, but it's not over at all, Betsy, because look at, you know, the Brett Kavanaugh thing, you know, the Bill Cosby thing took 60 women and 50 years to get him convicted. And who knows about Harvey Weinstein? So that really overt stuff is not even really clarified yet or, you know, gone today. And then this second one, this more subtle type of keep us out, is still very much there. And I today mentor a number of young women who are still dealing with that second category and pay inequity and that kind of stuff.
Well, what's interesting too about your story and of the articles of yours that I've been able to read too, that you don't see yourself as a victim in that kind of capital V victim way. You know, you're not kind of just out whining about all these bad things that have happened. You're talking about this as a sociological reality. This is what's going on. And you're a strong, articulate, intelligent, accomplished woman. And still this, you know, I think that people tend to think this stuff happens only to kind of, for lack of a better term, gentler or wimpier or less powerful kinds of women than you are. And here you are, this kind of, you know, clearly smart, accomplished powerhouse of a person, and it's still relentless.
It's still, yeah, it's a cultural thing. And in America, I mean, I've studied a lot. I did a lot of research for my book. I think it's one of the only memoirs that actually has references in the back.
Right.
You know, I wanted to focus on America because I think we have a particularly, patriarchal society here in this country.
Which is ironic, isn't it? We've tended to look at countries in the Middle East or other places and think of how they treat women as so backward from how we do. And certainly there are lots of opportunities here in the U.S. I'm not trying to compare, but isn't it interesting that the sexism and discrimination just takes a different form here? It's not, we're not being forced to wear burqas by any means. That's a different kind of oppression. But this is still going on today.
Yeah, and I'm particularly focused now on getting women into leadership positions, because every company you look at in the United States, there's pretty good hiring, equal men and women. But by the time you get to the higher ranks, there's like 10% women at the most and 90% white males. It's quite an issue in our country, in my opinion.
You know, what's interesting about that is I think that women tend to get the blame for that. They say, oh, well, it's just because she wasn't tough enough to make it, or she went on the mommy track instead, or those kinds of things, as opposed to saying, wait a minute, we've built an architecture that makes the high rafters of this structure impossible for women to participate in lots and lots of ways.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I do have advice for both men and women who are interested in changing the current dynamic. Hmm. So that's what I concentrate on in my book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, let's change this. And there's plenty of men who are interested in going along with it, you know, helping to make some societal changes. But there's some things we need to do.
You know, it also strikes me, you alluded earlier to the kind of idea that, you know, why don't women just say stop it? Or why don't they just say knock it off?
Or call the police or report it.
Call the police or report or whatever. Why don't they do that? Which is, it's interesting. I think that when we look backward at the era of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, young women today say, well, why didn't you just? And I always think, oh gosh, they're measuring yesterday's behavior by today's yardstick of having the kind of information that they have now. But you're even saying that today women are still having a hard time saying this.
Oh yeah.
Even in the Me Too generation, even in this. And do you think it's getting easier or harder for women to speak up because of the Me Too movement?
Well, that's a great question, because certainly there's a backlash. And I knew this was going to happen. There's, you know, Me Too came out, and then the whole thing with men being afraid to mentor a woman at work, being afraid to have a luncheon with a woman. You know, Mike Pence won't even, you know, meet with a woman because now they're afraid of us, right? That we're going to call them out. Right. So that's been a big problem for women in business now. And so it's not going away.
And I'm not by any means, of course, suggesting that the Me Too movement should stop it because it's harder. I don't mean to imply that. I think it's amazing. And I'm as Me Too as the next. I guess I'm just saying, kind of wondering about what are the reverberations there. And it seems like there's an act of bravery, and then there's a punishment, and then there's an act of bravery, and then there's a punishment. So Lucinda, on a personal level, going through this, enduring this kind of ongoing parade of this kind of behavior, in because you were in atypical environments, being a woman in that era, certainly, I'm wondering how you got through that. How did you said you had this parallel self, and you found yourself stepping into the role of your mom. What was going on for you when that was going on internally? And then what was the shift? What was the inspiration or decision or something? What made you say, no, I'm not going to internalize that anymore?
Yeah, I let it get out of control, and I wouldn't recommend waiting till you're going to pop to take action.
So wait, tell me what you mean by waiting until you're going to pop. What did that look like and feel like?
Well, I had things just really stacked up. I was working, I was getting my PhD, I was in an unhappy marriage, I had just had a baby. I just had a lot of things going on. I had two dogs and two cats, and I was doing everything. I was cleaning, I was cooking, I was trying to be the perfect wife, the the straight A graduate student, the good employee, the perfect mother. And I just one day felt like I was going to, you know, have some kind of a breakdown. So I sat down, and being a scientist, I guess, helps me is that I've always found breaking emotional feelings down into smaller tasks that I can complete one at a time helps with powerlessness. So I was just feeling so overwhelmed and powerless and accommodating, and like I was just a martyr, right? And I feel like probably a lot of people get to this point. But what I did was I wrote everything down in a list, and I said, what's contributing to these feelings? Like, what is making me unhappy and so feeling so out of control and weak? And I made this list, and I started with easy ones. You know, like I started with cleaning and cooking. The house does not have to be perfect. I'm going to try like not cleaning the house for a few weeks, letting the dust bunnies build up. I'm not going to cook food for my husband. He can get his own food. And so I tried some of those things, and I worked my way through this list. Like I was spending every night sitting in the bleachers at my husband's softball games, holding this crying baby who should have been home in its crib. And I said, you know, I was trying to prove that I was a supportive wife, right? And I said, I'm going to quit doing that. I mean, that was hard, Betsy. I mean, yeah. You know, when you're ingrained with some of these behaviors, but I said, I'm not going to go to the next baseball game and see what happens. And the world does not fall apart, or if you don't clean the house. And I took care of the pets, you know, that they were my husband's pets, but I took care of them, and I found homes for them, good homes. So I felt okay, but I took one thing at a time, and then when nothing exploded, I tried the next step. And it worked my way up to doing something about my job, and then finally doing something about my husband. You know, asking him to go to counseling. If he wasn't willing to go to counseling, we were headed for a divorce. And so that's how it went. And the only thing that was non-negotiable was my fabulous Dane, my baby. He was 7 months old at the time. And he was a joy in my life. And, you know, I knew he was going to stay. But everything else, I tried letting it go and see what happens. And sure enough, you know, you get this gradual self-awareness and growth of your esteem, you know, taking some of your rights back.
And did your husband go to counseling?
Once.
And so I'm guessing that that's not the marriage that you currently inhabit.
Yes, it is not.
I didn't mean to assume such. But
yeah, so I did get divorced and you know, finish my PhD and move. Mm-hmm.
So I like this how you brought your scientist self to the problem, that it wasn't about not feeling the emotions, but it was about setting those aside while you were solving the problem.
Yes.
There's something kind of wonderful about that.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think a lot of people make the pros and cons list, right? One way or another, but it sounds like you sorted it, not just into the pros and cons, but into the, what are the things that I can control and what are the things that I can't?
Yeah. And what I can do without, what if I give up doing this, is the world going to explode?
Yeah. Amazing how many things that we don't think are optional or that we just kind of robotically find ourselves going through, we suddenly say, no, wait a minute, why am I doing that?
Yeah. And then you build up resentment and then you find out you really don't have to be doing it. And you know, my dad used to hit us on the head with a spoon when we did something he didn't like. Mm-hmm. And I'd try something. And if I didn't get hit on the head with a spoon, that's what I used in my head. Like going like, oh, okay. I was always so afraid of that, you know, that I was going to get hit on the head with a spoon that I didn't act. But once you try it and it doesn't happen, you go like, oh, okay. Well, heck, I'm going to try something else.
And of course, when you made these changes, I'm sure it was met with wild applause from all of the men in your world.
Yes,
they were
right.
So glad to see that happen. Can you say a bit about what the reaction was when you started making these changes?
Well, yeah, you know, my mom saying, well, you can't divorce your husband. You know, you need a husband. My professors saying, well, what? You're not going to do what I say anymore. I mean, there was a lot of reactions but not as bad as I had imagined.
Really?
Yeah. So that's what kept me going.
You didn't get hit on the head with a spoon.
Yeah. I was still alive. It wasn't as bad as I thought. And I think that's some of my advice to people. Like, try things, be brave, try some things. And you'll see that your imagination is way worse than the reality.
Mm. Well, and also it sounds like there was also an internal shift that made that so too. It's sort of, you got to the spot where, and tell me if I'm guessing this right, but it sounds like you got also willing to have somebody not be all that thrilled with you at every minute. You weren't trying to please everybody and you were willing to live with them not being so pleased.
Yeah. A couple of ways I dealt with that pushback was that I searched, down in my soul for memories of better times when I had stood up for myself. And I think that's good advice for anybody. I mean, you can look in your life and, like, there was a time when I was in college or when I was a waitress and I joined in with other waitresses to get the manager fired who had been pinching our butts all the time. And we got him fired. And I remembered back to that and think, I did that at one time. And my baby Dane, I stood up for him all the time. And I thought, well, I don't want anybody bullying him. Why am I letting people bully me? So I thought about those kind of things. I just, like, go deep down inside to find times when you had been brave. And those helped me get a lot of new strength.
I like that, Lucinda. I like the idea of finding those brave moments that you've had in the past and using them and saying, well, I did it then, I can do it now. It makes me think of, it sounds like a silly analogy, but those ropes courses that a lot of organizations want you to go on, where you climb poles.
I've done that.
Yeah, me too. And a lot of people who've been in corporate settings or even nonprofit organizations, and they go on these ropes courses where they climb poles and walk across rickety bridges and cheer each other on. It sounds like it's like, if I can do that, then I can do this. And it sounds like for you, that was those moment of tapping into, wait a minute, I do have some strengths that I'm tabulating, and I can count on those. I can count on me.
Yeah. And it's not once one big, aha moment, like they like to have in books, like this is the culmination.
Right.
It's iterative. It's little baby steps at a time. And another thing I learned was about, I did move back to California because I had moved around the country for my job and my husband. And I wanted to get back where I had some support because I had been trying to do it all by myself. Cause that's like part of being brave and strong. Right. And I realized that I needed my network. So I moved back and I had my sister, I had my old friends who knew me, who really knew me, and that's one of my big advices for women in these kind of situations today, is to get a network and stick with other women and build that and get yourself strong by being with others. And not thinking that you have to do it by yourself, because it's not a good way to go. The other thing that was happening at the time was I started looking outside of myself. And that's another piece of advice I have for people. Like, really look, poke your head up and look around. And I saw Gloria Steinem, and I saw the first sexual harassment case before the Supreme Court being ruled in the woman's favor. And I saw, like, oh, wow, this isn't just me. Because I was definitely into a whole thing of self-blame. I thought it was me, right? I'm causing this. And a lot of women feel that, like, I wore the wrong dress, or I shouldn't even be here because this is a man's job. And I mean, I had all those self-doubts, but I started looking around and seeing stuff was happening, and it still is today. And so women, when they feel like this, I mean, it's so good to just, look up, get strength from others.
Good advice. So your book is Just a Girl Growing Up Female and Ambitious. And I know that you mentor women and you work with organizations to help continue to break these barriers and to change culture within organizations and perhaps within our larger American culture as well. Lucinda, thank you so much for your time and for this inspiring conversation. I'm so glad to have had you and glad to have learned about what you know about. I've got lots more to learn from you, I'm thinking.
Well, likewise. Well, thank you so much, Betsy. Nice talking with you.
In the extra blooms department after my conversation with Lucinda Jackson today, I got to tell you, my brain is just buzzing. I'm realizing how many connections I could make. And whether you are female, whether you are trans or gay or of color or from a different culture than you find yourself in, or even of a different age. I think this idea of being other, of finding that we acquiesce and smile along and don't want to make waves and don't want to cause trouble, that's just so woven into us. And I'm thinking about Lucinda's dad telling her, you know, boys won't like you if you are too smart. And I'm remembering being told similar things as a little girl by my grandmother when I was winning a game of Monopoly. And she took me aside and said, the boys don't like it if you win. How many of those little messages have we internalized? And even if we don't consciously, with above the eyebrows in our just our brains, even if we don't believe them, they seem to still be woven into our cells somehow. And we find ourselves following a pattern that we don't even know we're following. I'm really inspired by Lucinda Jackson's notion of connecting and of finding others to support you, and also to look back at times that you've been brave. Because if you've been brave once and it worked, you can be brave again. That's a big ol' extra bloom. Thanks so much for listening to The Morning Glory Project. You can find Lucinda Jackson in any indie bookstore or online and look up her book, Just a Girl, Growing Up Female and Ambitious. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Morning Glory Project. I so appreciate your time. Now, go out and bloom.